It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We focus on a family-run beef operation in Door County, in farming for over a century, and with an emphasis on sustainability and land management practices that we'll get into. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Bry is co-owner of Bry Cycle Farm and Bry Family Beef in Sturgeon Bay, 1,200-acre family farm managing about 600 dairy cows, 500 heifers, and 50 beef dairy crossbred cattle. Lauren, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the beef dairy crossbred cattle. How do you raise them?
Sure. Well, we are fortunate to have a dairy farm, and as a way to manage our herd size, we started breeding some of our dairy cattle to beef bulls several years ago, and then decided to locally market some of the calves. So we raise every animal on our farm from birth all the way to finish, which I think makes us a little bit unique from the beef side of things, depending on what part of the country you're in. So the animals are born here, they're fed milk until they're about 60 days old when they're weaned, and then they are moved to group pens where eventually they move over to our second location and get to be out on our pasture the majority of the year. We have what we call managed intensive grazing system, moving animals from paddock to paddock to eat different mixtures and crops to build soil health. And also it's a nice, affordable way to raise animals.
What is it like in your pastures? What are your livestock eating in each area?
It definitely depends. they were just grazing actually on some triticale, which is a cover crop that was planted last fall. But then we moved them to a different paddock recently where they're munching on a mixture of different cover crops. So that might include purple top turnips, radishes, hairy vetch, and a variety of other plants that are in a seed mix. So it just depends on which paddock they're in and what other things we might be doing with those paddocks throughout the year. So it's actually a way that we can use the land in multiple ways, not only to graze, but also maybe to harvest other crops, depending on the specific paddock that we're talking about.
What is your philosophy toward cover crops? What is the impact on soil health that you're observing?
We started our conservation journey really focusing on implementing different practices like cover crops in 2015 when we started taking over the farm from my husband's parents. So it's my husband and his brother, and then my sister-in-law are the main day-to-day operators. And cover crops were an easy thing to start with and to try and dip our toe in the water. We knew a lot of other farmers in the area were doing this practice, so we tried it ourselves and we saw some great results. There's definitely challenges with it as well, but having an open mind and being adaptable is one of our core values here, and that's really what we've been able to do on our conservation journey. So again, starting with cover crops and planting some rye the first year really helped us not only see that there's opportunities to double crops, so we can get multiple crops off of the same piece of land throughout a year by having a cover because we have livestock that we can feed that cover crop to. But then it's also helping build that soil health and, of course, protecting water quality through preventing soil erosion and keeping nutrients in the soil where they need to be instead of running to the water.
Lauren, what is your philosophy toward like no-till or not disturbing the soil through tillage?
We are trying to do as many conservation practices as we can. And it's, again, been a journey. So each year we've implemented something new. So not only the cover crops and then being able to double crop with winter forages, but of course no-till. And we expanded that by doing planting green, which is planting into a living cover crop. We did a little bit of that last year working with a local neighbor, and we hope to do more of that. We do some interseeding, of course, the grazing system that we implemented that we have our beef cattle on with some of our dairy heifers. So there's a big variety of things we can try, and each year we're attempting to do more and more. But of course, Mother Nature really dictates how things go on the farm. So We might have plans to do certain things that don't always pan out just depending on the weather, but we're always doing our best to implement as many conservation practices as possible. However, again, because of Mother Nature, we have to be adaptable, and you might need to change your plans at the last minute, just depending on what's happening, with the weather.
Lauren Bry with us, Bry Cycle Farm, Bry Family Beef, as we talk about sustainable practices in agriculture and the approach to the beef cattle side of the operation. You can join in with questions at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So with these conservation practices, what are the observations you make about your cattle, their health, and, the beef operation? Do you see an impact?
I think that no matter what system animals are raised in, as farmers, we're always doing our best to provide them optimum care. And there's a lot of factors that go into that, and each farmer has a unique situation. So we might raise our cattle a little differently than others. We are fortunate to have some land around our heifer and beef farm location that was suitable for grazing. Not all farms have that, so that's not always an opportunity for people. As well as living in Wisconsin, we know the weather is not always conducive to being outside, to growing crops. So that has also impacted the amount of time that we can have animals out on pasture, just because what the amount of feed that's available again depends on the weather, and making sure that they're safe and protected from the elements when it gets to be, the end of January and it's really cold. So there's definitely a variety of ways to raise cattle, but managed intensive grazing has been a great option for us, implemented in the past few years, again, for our dairy heifers and our beef animals, because we have a land base that's right next to our barn, so it's easy. We were able to also then expand some of that by working with a neighbor who had a field right next to some of our paddocks, and we worked with him to get a paddock put up around one of his fields and planted cover crops in there. That was actually where the cattle were grazing the first part of this year. So it's been a great journey, and we definitely see quality meat coming. Of course, that has to be part of it, right? We're raising beef cattle, and we want the meat to be high quality. So not only are they able to eat that high quality feed out on the pasture, but we also are able to supplement their diet with a total mixed ration or vitamins and minerals and other things that they need. We work with a beef nutritionist to make sure that the animals' diets are balanced, to make that high quality feed on the end. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, and having our dairy farm allows us to be a little bit flexible as well, because we already have some infrastructure to support doing some different things on the beef side.
So many variables to keep track of. Let's take a call now, Judy in Door County. Judy, hi, what would you like to say?
I can't stress enough the importance.
Oh, Judy, you're breaking up. Can you hear us?
Did I lose you?
Oh, now we can. Yep, go ahead.
I can't stress enough the importance of what this family is doing. I live in County. I'm on my 20-minute drive to work, and 7 minutes into it, I've passed 10 manure trucks. What is happening to our topsoil, which we almost have none of left, and our water quality is insane. There are farming practices that can protect us all, including the earth, and it's time for our legislature and the public to start understanding the damage that is occurring in Wisconsin and other states because of current CFO farming practices. Kudos to you. Thank you so much.
Judy, thank you so much for calling in. Lauren, go ahead.
Thanks for the call, Judy. And I would just want to say that all size farms are trying to do their best to protect soil health, water quality, and raise healthy animals. Farming is our livelihood, no matter the size of farm. And there's lots of families involved on larger farms. So I appreciate those comments. And I would encourage you to reach out to a local farmer. We'd be happy to host you for a tour, or I'm sure any other farmer would love to show you what they're doing, because I think it's just really important to get that local connection to see firsthand, on the farm, and you can ask the farmer directly, why they're doing certain practices. I'll also mention that manure, I know we might see a lot of trucks driving down the road some days, but it's a really valuable fertilizer from the livestock perspective. And we're always doing our best to utilize it most efficiently, but also apply it when it's most beneficial to the plants and protecting our soil and our water. One way that we're doing that on our farm and many other farms is through using what's called low disturbance manure injection. So you might see trucks on the road to transport it to a field where it will then be injected into the soil where it's applied right at the root zone so the plant can use it. And it's covered up with a little bit of soil after it's injected to keep it in the soil so it stays where it needs to be. So I just, again, encourage anybody who's curious about why farms are growing to reach out to a local farm in your area and ask about having a tour.
Lauren Bry is taking us into the work of farming beef cattle, giving us a tour, co-owner of a family-run farm with deep roots in Door County. During the conversation about farming, raise questions, call in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A longtime family farming operation in Door County is focused on raising high-quality, sustainable beef. We learn about their land stewardship practices, and you can join in at any point. Call in with a question for a farmer, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lauren Bry is here, co-owner of a 1,200-acre farm in Sturgeon Bay. Lauren, you bring up water and, of course, pesticide runoff, degrading water quality. What are some effective solutions in reducing pesticide runoff?
I think just runoff in general is something that all farmers are working to prevent. When we apply anything to our fields, we want it to stay there. So conscientious use of anything, any of our resources, is really at the core of what we're doing. And I think a big way that we've seen farmers working to address this locally is through the producer-led watershed protection grant program that's available through our State Department of Agriculture. And we're a participant in our local farmer-led watershed group that receives some funding from that program, Peninsula Pride Farms. And we're also participating in our local Door Kewanee Demonstration Farms Network. Both of these groups have allowed us to get together with other local farmers, trusted advisors, and experts who are helping us explore new conservation practices and also document the impact of the conservation that we're doing on the land. So it's a really effective way to get farmers together, to talk to one another, learn what our neighbors are doing, and have a venue to just explore that through field days, meetings, and that type of activity. But we've been taking that one step further now by participating in a sustainability project with Peninsula Pride Farms and 10 other farmers in Door and Kewanee counties, where we're looking at practices that we're doing on some of our fields and getting sustainability scores around that. And one of those scores is water quality, but then also doing a deeper dive using a different model and tool to look at how we're impacting our local watersheds. So farmers in this region and the entire state, I know, are really taking water quality and other environmental concerns seriously, and we're doing our part to implement new practices, try to improve, but also then document what we're doing to understand, are we really making a difference with some of these conservation practices? Because what works on one farm might not work on another farm. And so having that opportunity to then talk with our neighbors about what we're doing, what they're doing, really allows us that learning opportunity to continuously improve.
Do you find that there are like-minded farmers on these land practices that you are doing?
Yes. In the farmer-led watershed groups, there are a lot of really motivated, forward-thinking, progressive-minded farmers who are always striving to be better. And even the farmers who might not be participating, they're watching what their neighbors are doing. So I think that we're seeing a lot more people seeing that it's working, and whatever that might be on that particular farm, whether that's cover crops, no-till, reduced till, planting green, there's all different kinds of practices. And just seeing a neighbor try it might inspire you to try it. And we see the facilitation of that peer-to-peer learning just through these farmer-led groups. So I think there's just so much opportunity. And I would encourage any farmers listening too, if you haven't tried a conservation practice like the ones we've mentioned today, reach out to somebody in your neighborhood that might be doing it, because I'm sure they'd be happy to share their successes and their failures with you to help you get started on your conservation journey.
We heard from Vicki in La Crosse, called in to ask, what factors convinced you and your co-owners to make changes, and what incentives could be put in the farm bill to encourage similar changes like the ones you're making in land and water conservation?
Great question. I would say we're young farmers. We're motivated to make changes, to be on the cutting edge, to always be improving. My husband, Jacob, who does all the field work with some of our team members, is always saying that if you're not growing, you're not going anywhere. You know, something to that effect of like, you have to be changing and thinking differently and be open-minded and adaptable. So I think part of it was just being young and motivated to try new things, but also seeing our neighbors doing it. Being part of this farmer-led group opened our eyes to what a lot of farms were already doing. We just didn't know because we didn't talk about it farmer to farmer in a more public type of venue. So having that opportunity to get on another farm at a field day, talk with farmers in the area that we respect and admire, and get their input and their encouragement has also helped us. Mm-hmm. But then once we got started, we saw how beneficial it was for helping our equipment handle better in the really wet years by having more soil health. There's more water holding capacity. We can get the tractors through the fields easier if we've had cover crops in there. That type of thing also helped. Plus being more efficient with the land through using our cover crops as a forage source for our animals. It can be a little more affordable to do it and substitute it for some other parts of our cattle diet. So there's just a whole plethora of opportunities. And I think it's just getting somebody interested and speaking to them in a way that makes them excited to try it and seeing that other people are doing it too. A little bit of it is sparking that competitive spirit that all farmers have. We're cooperative, but we're also competitive. I think as far as incentives go, it just depends on the farm. There are a lot of cost share opportunities that are already available, whether it's through local farmer-led groups or NRCS has a lot of different opportunities as well. So I think farmers just need to explore what's available in their local community by talking to a local expert.
Oh, great. Lauren Bry, Brycycle Farm, as we look at sustainable farming practices. And you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Lauren, these large feeding lots, CAFOs, do you feel pressure as a family farm to scale up more, to manage more cattle, to improve your profit margins and compete?
We don't feel pressure to do that. I think we're motivated to grow because we are passionate about caring for the land. We're passionate about caring for animals and supporting multiple families in our family business. Farming is like any other business and you have to change with the times. So we're open-minded to adopting new technologies, but we're also open-minded to growth. And our farm has grown over time because we're supporting several families here, not only of us as the owners, but of our employees and providing opportunities for people to learn and to grow. So I would just encourage listeners to not be afraid of a farm because of its size. Big doesn't mean bad. Small doesn't mean good. There's room for all size farms, especially in Wisconsin. We see that diversity is great. And our farm has tried to diversify in different ways, not only through growth, but through adding our beef cattle, through raising heifers for other family dairy farms, and also through just trying new conservation practices. So I would encourage listeners to find a farmer in your area, get to know them, ask them questions, and you'll, I think, learn a lot and your eyes will be open because size doesn't define your farm. It's really the people And there's always people running a farm and behind every business. So just keep that in mind.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren Bry is a partner in Bry Cycle Farm and Bry Family Beef in Sturgeon Bay. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead of the Memorial Day holiday weekend, when people gather to honor veterans and share family cookouts, we learn about grilling techniques and how to bring out the flavor in high-quality cuts. Call in with a question. Share what you put on the grill. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Weber is owner of Weber Meats in Cuba City, the family's meat processing business established in 1905. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So when people visit their local butcher, perhaps you or the meat counter, what questions should they ask before making the purchase?
Well, first of all, we do have a big retail area in our processing area, in our processing plant. A lot of questions that are asked are, you know, where the meat comes from, the quality, whether it's, you know, the type of breed. Right now there is a big demand for grass fed, and we do have all. So we carry mostly here just choice Angus, and then most of the pork that we do here that we harvest ourselves. Chicken I gotta buy in, but we further process it, you know, as far as making sausage or trimming and making chicken and different flavored breast out of it. But the majority of the questions we try to have answered right away. And if we can't get an answer for you, then we will find out. But that pretty much is what most people are interested in when they come to Weber's.
Some people might be interested in how fresh is this meat, or, you know, do you grind the meat daily? What should we know about that?
Yeah, everything we do here, we cut daily. You know, our case is that we're busy enough that it is turned over quite often every day. Our hamburger and our pork sausages that we sell in the fresh case are ground fresh every day. We go through a pile of hamburgers. So, and what we do here is just strictly ground chuck. So I can only say what we do here at Weber's, but it is a good question to ask when things were prepared and how fresh they are that are in the case.
You mentioned the high demand for grass-fed beef, and we've been talking with a Wisconsin farmer who uses sustainable practices like rotational grazing and, you know, to maintain soil health and cover crops. Does the way an animal is raised affect the quality of meat?
Sure. You can tell the difference between a grass-fed and a corn-fed animal. When you look at the carcass and, you know, from the very beginning, your grass-fed cattle aren't as big as, you know, your corn-fed cattle. They don't have, you know, they have more of a yellow tint to the fat than, you know, the corn-fed cattle. It has more of a white. And the age has something to do with that too as well. You know, your corn-fed finish a lot quicker than your grass-fed, and the size. The grass-fed are usually a little smaller in frame and carcass than your corn-fed cattle.
Well, how about we bring out the grill now? What would you suggest are the best cuts of beef to cook on the grill?
Well, and beef, you know, the hamburger, you know, number one, I always like using ground chuck, you know, 80 to 90%, just depending on, you know, how much flavor, because fat is flavor.
Mm-hmm.
The steaks that we carry in ours, you know, everything is Angus. We do the ribeyes, New York strips, T-bones, and we do sirloin, but we just do the peeled top sirloin. It's more of a leaner. People don't want the fat as much, so much anymore. But what you're looking for in a good cut is the fat that's inside the meat. That's called marbling. So the more marbling is there, that gives it the higher quality grade. So you start with a select, then you go to a choice, and you go to a prime. Select being less amount of marbling, and then prime being more amount of marbling present inside the meat. That is going to be your most flavorful and your most tender is your prime. But you're going to pay for that too as well. They're the steaks we carry, the fillets we carry, we cut to order. They're more on the expensive side on all the steaks. Quality-wise, your New York strip, your ribeye, your T-bone, they're all in that same category as far as quality. Your fillet is going to be the top end. The sirloin would be the next thing down. And then, you know, you get into the round steaks and things like that. And they just acquire a little more preparation as far as like maybe tenderizing or a little more seasoning, cooking a little lower and slower. But your sirloin and the other steaks that I mentioned above that, you know, you can just pretty much just season, throw right on a grill.
Sometimes I'm going to have to flip, though, and I want to know your flipping philosophy. I mean, how do I prevent the meats from sticking to the grill?
Well, what I do, you know, on most of your thicker steaks, you know, I just lightly put a little olive oil on there, or either that or Pam the Great. It's just those two you'll prevent whatever you need as far as the sticking, either that or throw down some foil.
Mm-hmm.
And then pan that too as well. That works well with chicken. Then I just pull the foil off and then finish it off. Pork chops, sometimes I have, you know, you got to watch those too because, you know, with the foil, it makes it a little easier. But if you're trying to get the checkerboard effect, you need the olive oil and the high heat. And, you know, that's the quarter turn, like, if you're going to do a pork chop lightly, that's thick. I'm talking an inch and a half, 2 inches, like an Iowa chop, lightly covered with olive oil. Then take it and season it to whatever seasoning that you prefer. Have your grill at high heat, you know, 450, 500. Throw it on the grill. Give it about 3 minutes. Give it a quarter of a turn. Give it another 3 minutes. Flip it over and do the same thing. That will give you, you know, like when you go to a nightclub or a restaurant. And that's how they do that checkerboard effect on your steak. So then after you get it seared, you already locked in your flavors, and then you just finish it off to the way that you want it done.
Oh, I appreciate the step-by-step there as we talk with the local butcher, Dan Weber, about how to order and cook meat on the grill. Dan owns Weber Meats in Cuba City. You can join in with your questions about grilling, your techniques. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. Dan, you mentioned tenderizing, and there's also marinade. Can you go into that? Do beef cuts need to be marinated? What should we do about tenderizing? In preparation?
The only thing we do here as far as tenderizing is it just scores the meat. There's nothing added. Some places, you know, on a cheaper cut, they enhance it with tenderizing. That's a whole nother animal that we don't deal with. We just deal with good quality meat, so you don't have to do that.
Okay.
As far as marinating, the only thing we really do is I make a marinated barbecue pork chop is to die for. And then I have that for a sandwich. I came up with that idea for when I was in Illinois. The Illinois pork producers came to me and wanted me to come up with a sandwich, and that's what I came up for. I wish I had a penny for every one that we've sold, but the chicken, we do the same thing, and they're about the only two products that we really truly marinate. And that's up to you. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you get on Google and Google whatever as far as marinates and what you want to do, but I just tell people, you know, you're going to eat it. Mm-hmm. So marinate it on what you're going to eat.
Does soaking your steak in a marinade overnight, though, does it make it juicier, or does it change it so much?
Sure. I mean, you know, those marinades, they're just breaking down the fibers in the tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The one thing I do want to watch, too, is the amount of salt that's in there, because salt, you know, that pulls out the moisture. And the one other thing, you know, you just got to be careful on that, because you don't want to have something that's going to be dried out. In the marinade, as long as it's a wet marinade, you should be okay. But those dry marinades, you're going to have to watch so you don't have all your juices in the bottom of your pan or your plate before you start grilling. And that's another thing with grilling, is you don't want to be stabbing it with a fork. You hear the great thing, you know, you get a good steak, you get it on there, your best thing to use is tongs. You grab it with a fork, you stab it, and you put it on the plate, you get it in the house, and all of a sudden you look down and there's a bunch of juices in the bottom of the plate.
Hmm.
Well, you just erupted that piece of beautiful meat, and all your flavor is in the plate and not in the steak. So I always tell people, you know, you get that good steak, give it a couple minutes to rest, because when you're doing that cooking, the juices are everywhere.
And so, what's your philosophy toward flipping burgers? Should they be flipped only once?
You know, it depends. There would be is how big they are. A Dan Weber hamburger is at least a half pound, and I like them on the rare side. So it's just cook, flip, and flip, or and pretty much put on my bun. So the other thing there is how big the hamburger is and how well you want it done. I always like to just cook hamburgers on medium heat, because that's something you want to get done, you know, pretty much, you know, all the way through. I know our hamburger, I know how it's handled, and I only my hamburger I eat that way. But you know, you have to watch on what you're doing, because you don't want to make a you don't want to get sick.
That's right. Dan Weber, fourth generation meat processor in the southwest corner of our state. You can join the conversation about grilling ahead of the holiday weekend when families gather. Call in with a question. Share your grilling tips, techniques, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As families prepare for cookouts and barbecues recognizing veterans over the Memorial Day weekend, we're in conversation with Butcher Dan Weber about how to prepare high-quality meats on the grill. Call in with a question on Grillmaster techniques. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan, is it important to pat dry the beef or the chicken before placing it on the grill?
Well, that's your preference. I've never done it. Like I say, that'd be your own preference. If you want to do that, you know, go ahead. I don't do it myself. I just take it, usually just season it and throw it right on the grill.
And
here again,
should meat be room temperature or right out of the refrigerator? What are your suggestions there?
Yeah, for steaks, I do like to let them warm up. You bet. I just take and throw them on the plate and let them warm up for a little bit, and then before I put them on the grill.
And I really like some grilled barbecue chicken once in a while. How do I cook chicken on the grill so it doesn't dry out?
One thing on chicken is everybody wants to cook it to death. I know chicken has to be done, but
Looking at her right here.
I got a wife and daughters the same way. I know I do mine on tinfoil. It kind of, and I just cook it on medium heat.
Mm.
The one thing you do have to remember that with the chicken, you know, once it's done, you know, they always say to 170, 180. I know that in our lethality stages that we cook here, we were 165 or more, and some up to 170. But you still have that residual heat that when you're done with it and you're letting it rest, doesn't make a difference on what type of meat you're doing. The temperature is going to be going up before it goes back down. So if you cook something like a chicken breast, especially a smaller one, and you have it at 170, it'll probably go to 175, 180 before it goes down. Hmm. And that's what happens with in any of it, and especially chicken, and it gets dried out real quick. So I, you know, it's one of those questions, is it safe or is it not? You know, chicken is a touchy product when it comes to cooking, because you definitely want to make sure you get it done. I would just go lower, slower, and use foil. And then at the end, just brown it up. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Don't run it at such high heat right away, you know, and drying it out. I found that to be a little easier and a less chance of drying it out when we're done.
Are you a gas or charcoal person?
I do both. Mainly gas because it's quicker. Mm-hmm. Charcoal, I pretty much most of the time, you know, if I'm doing something, I indirect it, you know, get the coals hot and then bank them up to the outside so the center is open. And then I just grill that way. But for the most part, I'm just strictly because of the convenience on the gas.
Now, how is your last name the name of Weber Grills? Huh.
I don't know. That's strange. No relation.
Oh, okay. Was, but... I bet you've got that once in a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, no relation. Just the coincidence.
Any wood chips? You know, do you do anything experiment with wood chips at all? Get a smoky flavor?
We do that with pork.
Okay.
There's definitely, we use hickory. You know, that if what it depends on what you're looking for.
Ooh,
you know,
I love the flavor. Hickory. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. You know, if you use like apple and some of those other ones, that's a little heavier, smokier flavor. So, yeah, they're good. I mean, and that's what you want in the flavor of your meat, especially pork and chicken. Not so much in beef. I just kind of just cook the season or whatever. You know, I don't use in too much chips on that unless you're doing a brisket. Sometimes guys will do different flavors with briskets.
Now, do you soak your wood chips or do you just let them be dry? Like, how do you? Yeah.
Most of the wood chips on the market, you know, you do have to soak
those.
Okay,
yep.
I know some of those pellet ones, you know, that they use, and I'm not familiar with those, but I do believe that they use those dry. So it just follow the instructions on your grill or your smoker, and they should, or even when you buy the chips. Or the pellets, they'll tell you on what to do and what's the best application and how to use them.
So here's the thing. I want my grilled ribs to just fall off the bone.
Mm-hmm.
How do I make that magic happen every time?
I tell you what, the best way to do fall off the rib bones,
yep,
for ribs is start them in the oven.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, put some moisture in there, get them to where they're pretty much, you know, a pork rib on the back ribs. I put moisture, apple juice, or some kind of water. I steam them, and then they're lightly seasoned. And then I put them in the oven for about 325, for depending on how many I got in there. But they're going to be in there for 2-2.5 hours.
Mm.
I just check them, and if they're nice and tender, I take my tongs on each side. I pick them up. I throw them on the grill, which is already, you know, hot. And then I just start blasting the sauce to them. And once they're caramelized, it works every time.
Mm, I love that. So it's every a combination time. Of the oven
of
and
oven
the
and
grill. And you're doing more, yep, of that finish off on the grill. Are you using a dry rub at all?
Yes, I have a dry rub that I put on when I'm doing the cooking in the oven. Now, if you have a smoker, you can do the same thing.
Mm.
My smokers are on the larger side, so I, you know, just to do one rack of rib isn't going to work. So I just finish, I'd start them in the oven and then just throw them on the grill and finish them off. And if that's what you want, is the fall off the bone, that's how you do it.
Talking about Grillmaster techniques with Butcher Dan Weber about how to order and cook meat and do it well on the grill. Dan is owner of Weber Meats in Cuba City. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Well, we heard from Robert wrote in to ask you to talk about parasites in pork and other meats, and what should we know to stay safe?
Well, everything that we do here, you know, we're state inspected. So our inspectors, you know, when we're harvesting the animals, from the minute they come off the truck all the way through the harvesting end of it, you know, we are tested, you know, periodically, but not every batch, you know, as far as the quality of the pork. Now, if you see anything wrong with it, there's things that you're looking for when you're harvesting the animal that is going to say, oh, we have a problem. Well, then the state vet's called in, and then they're the ones that make the decision on whether that animal's fit for consumption or not. So otherwise, we don't harvest anything that's a questionable one. If it is, then we have the state vet come in, and then he makes the call.
So for us on the consumer end, we just got to make sure that the meat is properly stored and properly cooked and do all the right things there.
The one thing about it, Kate, people do, and, you know, especially there's the start of the grilling season. Number one, make sure the grill's clean. You know, it's been stored. This is the start of the grilling season. The other thing, too, is when you're preparing food, you know, you're working with a raw product. Mm. And cross-contamination is probably the worst thing out there that makes people sick. And what happens is there's a lot of people, they don't wash their hands in between. And especially if you're doing chicken and then you do pork and then you do beef and then you take that board and go out and pick up the cook and throw it back on that thing. You know, there's got to be a little logic in here on how to do that and be just a little bit conscientious of how you're doing things.
Got to sanitize.
Yes. And the first thing should be done is your beef, then your pork, then your chicken, then clean, and don't use them. You know, don't use that same platter or cutting board to go get your raw or your cooked stuff after you get it done. You know, have a clean plate and don't use the same tongs or whatever you're using for the raw when you go to put the cooked back on a clean plate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that cross-contamination is just, that'll get you.
Well, Dan, good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. Anytime.
Dan Weber owns a family-run meat processing company in Cuba City. And earlier, we talked with Lauren Bry, raising cattle in Sturgeon Bay. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.